I had a question for you this morning. And that question is, do you want to make a difference in your life? Most people do. Most people that I talk to, whether they're young or whether they're old, want to make a difference in their life. In fact, a lot of my life I've spent around young people, just like I do now, even when I was a pastor. In fact, I was a pastor who very often taught youth group, even when I had a youth leader. I would make times during the year that I would spend with the youth. And most of the time, youth and young adults are really focused on the fact that, you know what, we really want to be different. We don't want to just be normal. We don't want to just be ordinary. We really want to make a difference in this world. In fact, that's even true of non-believers, and that's why there are so many radical groups that do so many crazy things, because they're just looking for something to make a difference, to put their mark on this world. Now, I've been with older folks. In fact, I've been with a lot of people in their last days and even on their deathbed. And I remember many of them talking about, I just hope that my life made some difference. I hope that when I'm dead and gone, it's not all over with, but I hope that something I did, even if it was just one thing, but something I did made a difference in this world. And quite frankly, I think if all of us would pause for a minute and not think about anything that would distract us, I think that everyone in this room could raise your hand and say, yes, I want my life to count. I want to make a difference in this world. Particularly if you would choose to come to Northeastern Baptist College. There is something in you that says, I want to be different, and I want to make a difference, or you wouldn't be here. That's true whether you're a student, that's true whether you're a staff member, or you're a faculty member. The fact is it would have been easier for every one of you to go somewhere else. It would be easier for every one of us to just kind of go on with life. But you're here for a reason, because at some point in your life, you recognize that there's something different about this. God is at work here, and I want to make a difference. I want to be a part of something that is extraordinary that God is doing. And so I believe that all of you would answer today deep in your heart that, yes, I want to make a difference. So the question is, how can you do that? One of the things that happened in my life as president of Northeastern Baptist College is I receive resumes all the time. Sometimes those resumes are because somebody has read about us in Baptist Press, or they've ran across our website, or they've heard from a friend of a friend of a friend about Northeastern Baptist College, and they're interested in coming to work here. Maybe from everything varied, from a maintenance guy wanting to come to work here to someone who wants to teach here or some other staff position that is here. Very often I kind of smile and think, well, if they knew how we get paid around here, they probably wouldn't be sending the resume. But then I also get resumes all the time of people who say, listen, I hear God is at work in the Northeast, and if there's any way that God ever puts it on your heart to share this resume with a church or any avenue, whether it's an association for a work or for the state convention or whatever it is, I'm just giving you my resume. I'm praying for New England. I'm praying for the Northeast. I'm praying for what God is doing there. And I want to join it somehow. So here is my resume. And so I don't remember the last week where I didn't receive at least one. Sometimes they come through the info, and so Beth gets them, and she just forwards them to me. Sometimes they come through Dave's office because they pull him up on the website. Sometimes they come directly to me. Sometimes they come through a friend of a friend and say, hey, consider this guy. So I have read a lot of resumes. And one of the things that people try to do on their resume is show that they make a difference. And so they list out all of their accomplishments and all the things that they have done. And so this morning, as we're thinking about how can I make a difference, what I want us to do is I want us to look at a resume that I have created for you to consider this morning. And this is the resume of Elisha, because Elisha made a difference. Elisha made a difference. Now, I'm just going to quickly walk through some of the highlights of his resume. So if you want to follow along, you might turn over to 2 Kings in chapter 2, 2 Kings in chapter 2, because really the significant portion of Elisha's ministry, we see him mentioned earlier and we'll look at that later, but the significant portion of Elisha's ministry begins in the second chapter of 2 Kings, and we find the first thing that I would put on his resume is the fact that he was with Elijah when Elijah died. This is an amazing story, and we don't have time to look at all these. I'm just going to remind you of them. Some of you have probably read all of these stories. Some of you have at least heard some of these. But remember what happens is Elisha and Elijah are walking together, and they're going from town to town, and they leave Gilgal, and they're headed down the road, and Elijah looks at Elisha and says, I want you to stay here. God's called me to go somewhere else. And he says, no, as the Lord lives and as you live, I'll not leave you. And they walk down the road, and they get to another town, and some of the prophets, some of the schools of the prophets that these two guys have been teaching came, and they said, Elisha, don't you know that today is Elijah's last day on the earth? God is going to take him from you today. And Elisha says, I know, but I'm not leaving his side. And so they move to another town, and then to a third town. They get to Jericho, and again, Elijah looks at Elisha and says, Elisha, stay here. The Lord has told me to go across the Jordan. And he says, as the Lord lives and as you live, I'll not leave you. And so they go down to the Jordan River. And so Elijah takes off the mantle, the outward cloak, and he rolls it up and he strikes the Jordan River. And the Jordan River splits. And they walk across to the other side on dry ground. And he looks at Elisha and says, Elisha, what do you want? Why will you not leave me? What is it that you want from me? And Elisha says that a double portion of your spirit could rest upon me. And Elijah looks at him and says, Elisha, you've asked a hard thing. Saying, I don't know if God's going to answer this one. He said, but here's the deal. If you're with me when I go, then that's the sign that God's answered your prayer. If not, then no. And they walk along, and all of a sudden, a chariot of fire comes down. By the way, a lot of people think that Elijah was taken up in a chariot of fire. Read closely the text. He was not. The chariot of fire came and split the two of them, and so they were separated. They were no longer walking side by side, but Elisha could still see Elijah. And a whirlwind came and takes him, and he watches as he is taken up into heaven. And as the whirlwind takes him up, that mantle falls off of Elijah. And Elisha goes over and he picks it up. And he walks down to the Jordan River. And he strikes the river and says, where is the God of Elijah? And the waters part. And he walks across. And the sons of the prophets are standing there. And they said, truly, the spirit of Elijah rests upon Elisha. That's a pretty big resume starter. I don't know about you, but I mean, he's got my vote. You know, he can come be my pastor anytime just on that. But guys, it doesn't stop there. I want you just to consider with me. Go ahead and throw up the next one as we walk through. Consider with me Elisha's healing of water, Jericho. He comes back, and we see beginning in verse 19 of chapter 2, that he gets there, and the leaders of the city come to him, and they say, listen, this is a beautiful place, but our water's horrible, and because of that, we can't grow crops, and it's terrible. And so he says, well, give me a little water and put some salt in it. Well, that doesn't taste too good. How is salt water going to help? And so he goes and he dumps it in, and all of a sudden, the Bible says that God healed the water. I mean, this guy's off to a good start. The Jordan River parts, and now he heals water. And so the city is able to produce the crops that they need. Well, he begins to move from there, and some people begin to mock him. Some kids begin to mock him, make fun of him. And so in verse 24, we learn that he turns and he looks at these young people who are making fun of him as the prophet of God. And he pronounces a curse upon him, and he moves on. And two bears come out, and they kill 42 of them. I mean, I don't know that I wouldn't want to talk against the prophet of God after this one. And so we see this resume just continue to build. And as we move into the third chapter, it just continues again. And we see that the provision of water for an army comes at Elisha's word. the northern kingdom, the southern kingdom, and they were going to war, and they would go out to war, and there's no water for their troops, and they search for water and search for water, and they can't find it, and they go to Elisha and ask him what to do. And at Elisha's word, Elisha says this. He says, I want you to dig trenches, and though you'll see no rain, tomorrow morning you'll have water. Yeah, right, Elisha. But they dig the trenches, and there's no water anywhere to be found, and they go to sleep, and the next morning it's full of water, and they're able to get the strength that they need. His resume just continues to flow forth. And so we see that as we continue just walking through this chapter, we come to chapter 4, and we find how that God uses him to touch a widow. And we see that this widow comes to him in chapter 4, and she says, listen, she said, you know my husband. He was a prophet of God, and he faithfully served, but now he's died, and me and my sons, we have nothing to provide for ourselves. He served faithfully, and now we're in trouble. In fact, the creditors are coming to take away everything I got. And I don't know what to do. And Elisha says, listen, I want you to go. And he said, what do you have? And she says, I have just a little bit of oil, and that's all I have. And he said, okay, I want you to go borrow all the pots and all the pans you can from all of your neighbors everywhere. Just borrow them all. Borrow everything you can get. And so her and her sons go out, and they borrow all these, and they bring them back. And she said, okay, I've gathered them. What do I do? And he said, just start pouring out of that little pot of oil that you have into all of them. And I tell you, God will allow all of them to be filled. And so out of this little pot, she begins to pour into pot after pot after pot, and the oil. Boy, does this sound a little bit familiar to Elijah's life? Different. But look what's happening. She's just filling all these, and she gets it all done. And he says, are there any more? And she says, no, we've gathered all the pots we can find. There is no more. And he said, now go and sell it. And sell all of that oil, and you'll have enough to pay your debts, and you'll have enough for you and your children to live because God will take care of you. And so, again, Elisha amazingly being used by God. He then goes to a Shunammite later in the chapter, in chapter 4. And he goes to this woman, and as he's walking through, she tells her husband, she says, listen, this man is a prophet of God. Let's prepare a room so that anytime he comes to our area, he can stay there. And let's just let him stay there for free anytime that he comes. And her husband agrees, and so they make this place that is just right, this prophet's quarters for Elisha. And every time Elisha would come, he would have a place to stay in. And so Elisha tells his servant, says, listen, I want to do something special for these people. I want you to find out what her husband and son need. What is it that they need? And so as they're trying to figure out what is the need, she says, listen, the husband, she has a husband, but she has no son. She's barren and her husband's old, and there's no hope of a child. And so he calls the woman, he says, listen, a year from now, you're going to give birth. And a year later, we read in the text, she gave birth, amazingly, like Sarah. Wow, an amazing thing. And the child begins to grow, and he works with his dad out in the field. And one day he's out in the field, and he has a bad headache, and he tells his dad, and his dad carries him to his mother's lap, and he dies in his mother's lap. And she goes to Elisha, said, did I ask for you a child? No, you didn't ask. Did I tell you don't deceive me in my old age that I could have a child? Yeah, my child's dead. Elisha goes. First sends a servant ahead. The servant takes his staff, lays it on the child who's laying in the bed. Nothing happens. Elisha gets there, and he goes up, and he lays on top of the child. And he gets up, and he paces the floor, just praying out to God, and he lays on him again. And all of a sudden, it says that the child begins to cough, and he comes back to life. Amazing. Pretty powerful resume. I haven't seen too many people raise people from the dead, folks. Okay, let's be honest. I've never seen anybody do that. Pretty amazing resume. this child raised from the dead. But guys, it doesn't stop there. You just keep flipping through over and over, and you just begin to see all of these different ones. We'll just start throwing them up there as we walk through. The fact that he heals poison out of a stew. There's stew that's made, and it's poisonous, and he takes flour and puts it in the stew, and instead of just making it clumpy, it actually healed the stew. We go on from there, and we see that he feeds 100 men on just a little bit of food. A foreshadowing, possibly, of Jesus feeding the 5,000 men plus women and children, or the 4,000 men plus women and children. He has these men to feed. He tells his servant to feed them. Some man had provided a little bit of food, and his servant says, there's not nearly enough for 100 men. And he says, listen, the Lord says, feed them, and there will even be leftovers. We just continue to see his resume build. Consider the healing of Naaman, probably one of the most famous stories of Elisha, and how the servant girl, her master has leprosy, and she gets the word to him, you need to go see Elisha, and he sends word with Naaman to the king of Israel saying, heal this man. And the king of Israel's like, oh, I can't heal him. Who does he think I am? Elisha here says, send him to me. And so they send him out to him. Elisha wouldn't even come out to see him. He sends his servant out. And he says, Naaman, go dip in the Jordan River 7 times. The Jordan River, all except for in its headwaters, throughout all of Israel, other than way up in Caesarea Philippi, is dirty, muddy, ugly river. And Naaman says, are you kidding me? We got cleaner water where I come from. And he said, just do it. His servants talk Naaman into it, and he goes and he dips himself 7 times, just as Elisha said through his servant. And the 7th time he comes up and the leprosy's gone. He returns to Elisha in great thanksgiving and wants to offer him gifts and gold and clothes and everything. Elisha says, no, I don't need all that stuff. I don't need it. Just go ahead and go. And so he leaves, and Elisha's servant gets greedy and he decides he wants it. So he chases him down and says, oh, by the way, my master changed his mind. He would like some of that. And so he takes it and he comes back secretly. And when he gets back, if you see on the next one up there, what happens is Elisha knows what he's done. The Spirit of God must have spoken to him. He confronts him on it. And then he says, now you'll have Naaman's leprosy because of it. And his servant becomes leprous. His resume just continues to build. What an amazing thing. We continue to run through some of these. Just go ahead and put them up quicker. You know the story about the axe head floating. You know about his capture of the Assyrians, how they come against him. And there's armies all around. And he tells his servant, listen, there's more with us than there are with them. And so the servant's eyes are open and he sees all the angels of God who are there. And then we see as he comes, they come to the door. He comes and prays blindness on all of them. And then he leads them into the stronghold of Israel in Samaria. And they're surrounded by Israeli troops. And then he says, now open their eyes. They've been captured. Amazing. Amazing. We see another time in chapter 7 when the Syrians are coming against them and Israel is blockaded. They're stuck inside and in the city of Samaria. They can't get out because they're surrounded by their enemies and famine hits them and there's nothing to eat and they're dying. It's a horrible time. Just reading it will make you sick what was happening. And there's a man who says, it's all over, it's done. And Elisha steps in and Elisha says, listen, I'm going to give a prophecy. I'm going to tell you that by this time tomorrow, there'll be food plentiful. And one of the servants of the king says, that's impossible. Even if God opened up heaven and rained down food, that would never happen. And Elisha looked at him and says, it will happen. And you'll see it with your eyes, but you won't get to taste it. You'll be dead. And the next morning, God had moved on the Syrians, and they fled. Some lepers found it. They came back and told them, the Syrians are gone, and they left all of their food, and they left all of their clothes, and they left all of their gold. See, look, here's some of it. The king thought it was a trick, so he sent some people to check, and sure enough, the case was there. And so they come back and report, yes, it's there. And so all the people flee out of the city of Samaria to go and to grab this stuff. And in the process, the servant who spoke against Elisha is trampled underfoot. What he speaks happens. Elisha made a difference. We can jump forward and we can consider his prophecy of protection for that same woman with the child. A famine is about to come, and he tells her God is going to send a famine, so you go to the area of the Philistines and you be cared for, and she is. And then she returns, and the king, hearing her story, gives her her property back. We consider Elijah's last prophecy in 2 Kings chapter 13 when he has the sickness of which he will die, and the king comes to him and says, listen, I'm concerned about the Syrians coming against us. And so Elisha on his deathbed says take a bow and arrows, and he does. And he says, open a window, and he does. And he says, shoot the arrow, and he does. And he says, so God will use the arrow to destroy them. And then he tells him, now grab the arrows that are left. And he does, and he says, hit the ground. And so he hit the ground three times. And Elisha said, why did you stop at three? He said, now you'll only defeat him three times. But if you would have continued to hit the ground, God would have destroyed Syria by your hand. But because of your lack of faith, this is all that will happen. And then in verse 20 and 21, we have his death. He dies. They take him out. They bury him. Sure enough, it's not long. Time passes, and Syria is once again troubling Israel. Another man dies, and they take him out to bury him, and there are raiders from Syria that are coming. They quickly know they have to deal with this guy. They don't have time to prepare a grave for him, and so they just open the tomb of Elisha, and they let the man down into the tomb. And the Bible says in 13:21 that when the dead man's bones touched Elisha's bones, that he came back to life and crawled out. Guys, Elijah only raised one person from the dead. Elisha raised one while he was alive and one while he was dead. Now that is an impressive resume. Elisha made a difference. By the way, if I get one of those tomorrow, and it's verifiable, we'll hire him. Because we won't have to worry about him eating. God will take care of him. But let me ask you a question. There's no question that Elisha made a difference. But here's my question now. What made Elisha different? Why not one of the other sons of the prophets? Open your Bible again to 1 Kings, where we're first introduced to the man. 1 Kings in chapter 19. Long before he was this great leader, we find the call of Elisha described for us in this chapter. In the 19th chapter of 1 Kings, just three verses, 19 through 21, we have his call and his commitment, and we will look at each of those. But first, I want you to consider his call with me. Look there in chapter 19, verse 19 of 1 Kings. So he departed from there, that's speaking of Elijah, and he found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen before him. And he was with the 12th. And Elijah passed by him, and he threw his mantle on him. And he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, please let me kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow you. And he said to him, go back, for what have I done to you? What an interesting call. When I was young and considering the call of God in my life, I made it a practice to ask preachers about their call. And I would say, how do you know for sure that God called you? What is it about your call? And I heard a lot of preachers try to describe their call, and it always left me wanting. This is the most interesting call I've ever heard or read about. Elijah is facing a very difficult time. You remember, in fact, the entirety of Elijah's ministry is marked by great triumphs and deep tragedy. Elijah comes on the scene just a couple chapters earlier. He does this amazing thing by going to the wicked King Ahab and his wife Jezebel and saying, because of your wickedness, God said it will not rain until I say so. And he leaves, and it doesn't rain for 3.5 years. 3.5 years later, God says, go back and tell him it's going to rain. And he goes back to do it, but in the process, before he actually gets to that, they have to have a big showdown that he is Elijah's most known for. You remember up on Mount Carmel, you had the prophets of Ashtoreth, the prophets of Baal combined, that's 850 prophets standing on one side, Elijah on the other, and God gave a great victory that day for his work. Not only that, but following that wonderful win on Mount Carmel, the next thing that took place is that he tells the king, says, Ahab, hurry up and get home because the rain is coming. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. But he got down on his face before God and he prayed, and 7 times he sent his servant to go back to the top of Carmel and look out over the Sea of Galilee, or the Mediterranean Sea, to see if there might be a cloud out there. And 6 times he comes back saying, no, there's no cloud. The 7th time he said, well, there's one tiny cloud the size of a man's hand. He says, go catch Ahab and tell him to speed it up or he won't make it home. God's going to send rain. And God does. It's an amazing thing. And so Ahab gets back and he tells Queen Jezebel what had happened. And she sends word to Elijah and says, you killed all those prophets. And she said, by this time tomorrow, I'll kill you. And so he runs. And he runs with all that he has. And he sleeps. God protects him. But he runs. And then God tells him to go to another place. And he runs all the way back to Mount Horeb, to the place where Moses was, spent time with God. And he's there and he's pouting and he's upset. And God says, what are you doing here? And he says, I've been zealous for you. But that wicked king and queen have killed all your prophets and I'm the only one left. And they're seeking to kill me. I've worked hard. It's done me no good. It's done your work no good. I wish I'd never been born. He goes on and on and on. God sends a mighty wind, but the Bible says he wasn't in the wind. Sends an earthquake, wasn't in the earthquake. Sends a fire, wasn't in the fire. And then a still small voice. And then ultimately, God confronts him. He lays his complaint out again. And God says, listen, I've reserved 7,000 people of the nation who have not bowed the knee to Baal. You think you're all alone, but you're not. You don't see where things are going, but I got this. You don't know what's going on, and you're discouraged, and you're depressed, but I want you to know I'm doing exactly what I intend to do, and no king and queen can thwart what I'm going to do. And he says, I want you to go to Syria. He put him back to work. He said, go to Syria, and I want you to anoint their next king. Then I want you to go to Israel and anoint their next king. And then I want you to go find Elisha. And I want you to call him to be prophet in your place. And so we come to this passage and we see the call of Elisha. And you understand that what is going on is very difficult. And so Elisha was called of God in difficult days. Ladies and gentlemen, hear me good. You have been called here in the most difficult days our nation has ever faced. It is ugly. Everybody knows the election's ugly. Everybody knows, if they're thinking at all, that when the election's over, it doesn't matter which one wins, it's still going to be ugly. In fact, probably uglier. Our nation is facing difficult days. But in the midst of those difficult days, God is still calling people to join Him in His work, just like He was in Elijah's day. And Elisha was one of those. The times were hard. The days were difficult for anybody who would claim to follow the Lord. But God sends Elijah and says, Elisha, in the midst of these difficult days, come follow me. Interesting way, he just takes that outer coat and he throws it on him. By the reading of the text, it seems he didn't even stop. He just walked by him. He's out plowing in the field. He takes his mantle, throws it on him, keeps walking. But he understood it was the call of God. When I ask all those preachers, how do I know that God is calling me? I would ask about their call, and they would try to describe it, and it just left me confused. And I'd say, well, how would I know if God is calling me? And every one of them made me mad because they said, you will know. And that's it. But folks, I want you to hear me. God knows how to speak to your heart and let you know of his call. Some of you have heard it. Let's be honest. Some of you are hearing it clearly for the first time right now. And that's what happened. It was difficult days, but he was called. He was not only called from difficult days, he was called from the comfort of wealth and leadership. You say, really? Yeah, you can see. Look at the text with me again. Look in verse 19. He departed from there and he found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen. As you don't have 12 yoke of oxen with servants pulling those or behind those oxen unless you've got some wealth, particularly in that day. And he was the last one. He was the 12th. So he was their leader. He probably stood to inherit the riches of his dad. He was a leader of men, a leader of, and he had wealth. He had more than most people. And yet God called him away from that. Can I promise you something? I don't care whether it's wealth or whether it's leadership or whether it's whatever it is in your life, but when you follow God's call, he will always call you to leave your comfort. Sometimes it is wealth. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes he lets people keep their wealth. But he always calls people to leave their comfort zone, whatever that is. In fact, he also called Elisha to leave the comfort of his parents' house. Because we see there that Elisha actually asked the question in verse 20. He says, please let me go kiss my father and my mother. He probably stood to inherit it. His parents were most likely older, and he was probably controlling their wealth at this point. But he had to actually leave that comfort, that comfortable position, not only of wealth, not only of leadership, but also the comfort of being with his parents. I remember when I was a young kid, and I loved my family. And Cheryl could attest that as the youngest, when people would get married, I was excited and sad at the same time because I knew they'd be leaving our home. And then we would have get-togethers where family would come back. And it was always hard to see my family leave. And I remember praying, God, so many of my friends, all their family lives within an hour and they get to see each other all the time. Could you let that be for me? And as soon as I turned 18, God moved me out of the state. And he continued to move me away and away and away. And now I praise the Lord that he's brought Cheryl and Harv and Sam and Crystal within this region. But guys, most of our family is scattered all over this country serving God in different places. I have just accepted that we get together at funerals. And every time, one other's gone. It's not comfortable. But God calls you to leave the comfort behind and serve him. That's what he did for Elisha. Difficult days. Leave the comfort of your wealth. Leave the comfort of leadership. Leave the comfort of your family. And come serve me. Now, it's easy to say, whoa, wait a minute, why did he want to go back and kiss his father and mother? You know, he really shouldn't have done that. And if it wasn't for verse 21, I might agree with you. But there was more to his motivation than just saying goodbye. And we find it in verse 21. And in verse 21, I want you to look with me and understand. I want you to consider not only Elisha's call, but his commitment. We see it in verse 21 when he says, "So Elisha turned back from him, and he took a yoke of oxen, and he slaughtered them, and he boiled their flesh using the oxen's equipment, and gave it to the people, and they ate. Then he arose and followed Elijah and became his servant." Now, when he first asked Elijah, "Can I just go back and say goodbye?" Elijah, guys, he's still depressed at this moment. I mean, he's doing what God told him. He left Horeb. He went back. He anointed the kings. You know, he kind of half-heartedly calls Elisha. And Elisha says, can I just go back and say goodbye? And he turns and looks at him and says, "Oh, just go back. What have I done to you?" Because he knew what was coming. Why? Because he had been through it. And he felt bad for the difficulties that he knew Elisha would face. And so he said, "Just forget it." But Elisha does turn back to demonstrate his commitment. Listen, Elisha first sacrificed his possessions. Notice what it says in the text that he did. He turned back from him in verse 21. He took the yoke of oxen. This was how he plowed the field. And he slaughtered them. And then he boiled their flesh. And to make the fire to do this, he didn't go home and gather the stuff to do it. He does it right there in the field. He takes the oxen, he unhooks them, he takes the plows, he takes most likely the yoke, he takes all this stuff, and he puts it down, and he builds a big bonfire, and he cooks the oxen. He's saying that's it. It's like Cortez when he went to the New World and he burned his ships so that his army couldn't return. That's what he's doing. He's saying, look, I've lived a life of reliance upon what I own. I've lived a life of reliance upon my daddy's riches that I stand to inherit. And so I'm just going to get rid of them right now, so that the only thing I have to trust is God Himself. And he sacrifices his possessions. God calls some to do that. He called Barnabas to do it in the New Testament. Others he don't. But the point is when he calls, what will you do? His commitment was such that he sacrificed his possessions. Not only that, after doing that and cooking the food, he gave the food away. I mean, he just cooked it. I mean, I think I'd have been trying to take some of it with me on the journey. Okay, God, I got rid of it all, so this is how you're going to provide for me and Elijah for the next 30 days. No. He gives it all away to the people that are there. He takes all of those that oxen that he had cooked, and he gave it away. Demonstrating his commitment. Demonstrating more than anything, his faith in the almighty power of the Almighty God. And he sacrifices it, and he gives it all away. Now don't miss this. Look at the end of the verse. They ate, then he arose, and he followed Elijah, and he became his servant. His commitment was a commitment to be the servant to Elijah. This is a word that means he waited on him. Most of the time used for menial labor, menial task. He left his wealth and his riches, his leadership, to become a servant of the man of God. The rest of 1 Kings, don't really hear much about him. In fact, we don't hear about him at all. Anything we hear about is about Elijah. Chapter 1 of 2 Kings, it's all about Elijah. All that time, he was just serving. He was just serving. Can I tell you what I believe one of the biggest problems in Christian leadership is today? We want to serve God, and we want the cool resume. But we will only do it if God does certain things for us. We'll only say yes if, God, you give me the salary I want, the car I want, the house I want, the clothes I want, the people around me to help me that I want. And we put conditions on God. And then we wonder why we have very little effect on a lost and dying world. Do you know why? Because most of the world sees people going into Christian ministry, whether it's as a pastor, church planner, counselor, missionary, or anything else, as all you're doing is you've chosen that as your path of career, and you're advancing in your career too, just like I am. It's rare that somebody will lay it all on the altar and saying, God, everything I have is yours. And I'll sacrifice it all for you. I'll abandon it all only for the sake of fulfilling your call. And when we have a generation that will raise up and do that, we'll see a change in the Northeast. We'll see a change in the world. Do you want to make a difference? You can make a difference. But half-hearted commitment, talking about faith without living it out, will never get us there.